Don't look now, cause your 15 minutes are running out. See that good time is heading to stay. Don't look now, fire's out. Welcome to Don't Look Now, the podcast with your hosts, Jenny McDonald and Will Hageman, coming to you every Tuesday with our podcast of the week. Our topics, including all kinds of random stuff, as always. Could be history, could be mystery, could be random cults, could be Victorian era inventions. Who knows? Actually, the only one that does know is Jenny, who is going to give me some hints as to what it is. And you, because you're able to see this after we recorded it and we actually have, you know, a title and whatnot. But I got no idea what we're about to do. So, Jenny, give me a clue here. What are we talking about this week?
Okay, so you said history, mystery, cults, and what was the fourth one?
Random Victorian inventions.
Okay, take away cults and you got it, man. You're so all close. Right.
History and mysterious random Victorian inventions. All right.
And I'm going to mess with you just a little bit and tell you it's a threefer.
Oh, man. Let's see what... I don't know, a threefer on the weird-ass inventions of Kellogg and his weird sex-obsessed health lifestyle with his cornflakes. How's that? That'd be...
You know what? That is a really good guess, but I'm afraid that I'm going to have to be a little bit more intentional with my guesses for you, because my guesses are based on people.
Okay. A
couple of them do happen to be inventors, but people who disappeared and reappeared, kind of.
Kind of. All right. Wow. All right. I have no clue.
Great. This is fantastic. So I love it when I can throw you for a loop.
All right. So what do we got here?
So most of these took place in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Okay.
So the first one we'll start with is a man by the name of William Cantello.
All right. That does not ring a bell.
When I read this, I was like, this is some real bullshit. This is a lie. Because it was like one of those little clickbaity articles.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to read this anyway. And then I read it and I was like, nuh-uh. Then I was like, Wikipedia, what you got for me, sis? What? Nice. This is a real, like, a real thing? Okay.
All right. Nice. All right.
So William Cantello is our first contestant. Okay. He's a 19th century inventor, because we know I love the phrase inventor over scientist.
Yes. I get instant images of Heinz Doofenshmirtz and his innator of the week sort of thing with inventor, as opposed to, you know,
absolutely how I feel about this guy.
Yeah.
Like, just, you can see him in the white coat and everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's an inventor who was rumored to be working on an early version of a machine gun.
Yeah.
He just up and leaves his house one day and never returns. So the question is, what the hell happens to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the early 1880s, the residents of Bargate Street in Southampton were probably a little bit fed up with him. Beneath the pub that he ran is a basement cellar, whatever the hell you want to call them in England, right?
Mm-hmm.
And William Cantello runs this pub, but he also likes to hang out in the cellar, and people would hear the sound of rapid gunfire. So it scared the hell out of the neighborhood constantly, right?
I got to love somebody testing their new machine gun invention in their basement next door. Yeah.
In the basement of the pub, of all places, right?
Yeah.
So he's an engineer and a gun maker and a pub owner, and he's experimenting with a new kind of gun. Nobody knows what it is, but they do know that it just shoots in rapid succession. It's clearly not the average rifle.
Mm-hmm.
So one day he announces to his sons, who are also engineers/inventors, that he had perfected his newest invention. And you know, that just feels like the beginning of a movie, right? It just feels very grand. And then we're going to have huge, something crazy is going to happen. So this is a machine gun. It's a weapon in which they use the energy of explosive recoil to load the next bullet. It would just continually fire until they ran out of bullets. It's pretty revolutionary at the time, which, yes, I would agree, that is pretty revolutionary in the 1880s.
Yeah.
So he and his son pack it away into cases, and he goes off, presumably to sell it. And they're all pretty excited, because this is a pretty, pretty big deal, right?
Yeah.
And he had frequently traveled on sales trips. He was kind of a successful builder of random-ass shit, usually, though, ship cap stands and other parts of marine engineering.
Hmm.
Here's the thing, though. he disappears, and William Cantello himself is never seen again.
Huh.
Seems very strange, right?
Yeah.
So then we flash forward. It is now November 1916. A bunch of people are dying in World War One, and the machine gun is being used. The inventor of the machine gun died. The inventor of the weapon, the machine gun, had died. He had been very rich, and he had been knighted. His invention revolutionized warfare, and basically everything else became pretty useless because this was super easy to mow down the enemy with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So armies retreated into trenches. Generals tried to figure out what to do to fight this kind of war. And the question is, who had done this work, right? So the answer to that question is the person who's buried in southern London. So he has a large, impressive monument, but there's no indication on the monument of what he did for a living. It just had his name, and his name is Sir Hiram Maxim. So he is credited as the inventor of the rapid-firing belt-fed gun. It has his name on it, the Maximum Gun. It was the weapon of choice in the late Victorian and Edwardian era because it was bringing industrialization to the business of killing people, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Big frickin' deal. All the documentaries and everybody that would later come around would say it changed the world forever because it was such a big deal. So the question, why is this guy so important to the William Cantello story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we know from this story originates from a column in a local newspaper in the 1930s. This is when descendants and friends of William Cantello are still alive at the same time as Hiram Maxim. So the article contains a photograph of Cantello. And if you look at a photograph of Cantello and a photograph of Maxim, they are the same freaking guy. So Cantello's sons are, you know, sad and despondent because they never found out what happened to their father. And they pick up the newspaper one day and there's a picture of Maximum on the newspaper talking about how he had invented this machine gun. And they look at it and they're like, that's my dad. And they're really excited because they're like, oh my God, we finally found him.
Mm-hmm.
So they chase down where he's located and they find him at the Waterloo station and start shouting at him, dad, dad. And they go running after him, trying to catch up to him. Yeah. But his train pulls away before they can catch him. So his family engages a private detective to start to look for Maxim. What they initially found when he started his work looking for Cantello is that he was traced to America and then disappeared. Hmm. A large sum of money had been withdrawn from his bank account, but the bank long since had ceased to exist, and there was no record of what happened to the money, just that it was withdrawn. So the downside is that we're talking Victorian era, and much like you, dear Will, they had glorious beards. So you, like, a beard will hide a lot of facial features, so yeah. Pictures look similar, but is it just because they got beards?
Yeah.
And, like, we don't have facial recognition, we don't have a lot of things to do that, so you could look at lots of pictures of people and they just look alike. So it's possible that they had a picture of Cantello and they just mixed it up with Maxim. Hmm. Unknown. However, this doesn't explain what happened to Cantello, right?
Yeah.
So we do know that he existed. He was well known in Southampton. Gun making did run in his family. There were a lot of people in the Cantello family line who made improvements to rifles, and at least one of them had moved to America at some point. Maxmean, on the other hand, had come to Britain from America, where he had made enemies by arguing with Thomas Edison. Everybody argued with Thomas Edison, didn't they? Did anybody get along with this man?
Yeah, I don't get the feeling he was a particularly nice guy.
No. So he made enemies by arguing with Thomas Edison over who invented the light bulb and was just kind of a pain in the ass. So he got shipped off to Britain. He also had written an autobiography of a man who was his double, who was going around the U.S. impersonating him. So the question was that Cantello or was it his own brother who also looked just like him and also had a giant beard? Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? But the thing is that we did have reports of this rapid fire gunfire beneath this pub.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that the two of them would have such an eerily similar product.
Yeah.
It just makes no sense that they would be two separate people. We don't know whether or not they ever met, but there is actually evidence that these two people may have been the same person or met. So the daughter of another Southampton marine engineer called Philip Brannan wrote a letter at the time on how Maximum had come to Southampton to see the type of propeller her father had invented. He had told his staff not to show it to him, though, because Maxim, she said, had a reputation for brain sucking. He stole shit.
Nice.
His reputation preceded him. He did have a tendency to plagiarize ideas, though. So that's not uncommon for, you know, inventors of the era. But it is Edison, interesting that it was the same area that Cantello went missing from. So I don't have a good answer on what happened to Cantello. The question is, did he realize that Maximum had stolen his idea? Did something happen to him and he gave it away? Or was there just some sort of like similar entanglement? Unknown. Unknown.
Man.
But possible.
Somebody needs to dig this guy up and then check all of Cantello's extended family or something and figure out if there's
a genetic
match.
DNA work.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty sure they're going to agree to that really easily over in Britain, just as an FYI.
It's been a while. Nobody cares anymore, right? You can just
everybody loves to dig people up. We're almost at, I mean, we're looking, what, 1860s?
Yeah.
We're almost there. You wait.
I mean, we've been busy digging up, you know, Zachary Taylor and Billy the Kid and everybody recently. So, you know, I'm sure we can just dig up
another. Anything over like 115 years is considered archaeology. Everything else is grave robbing, right?
Yep, yep.
So let's go to a person number two. And no, these stories don't have anything in common other than they were missing and reappeared. Sorry.
Yep. It's a good thing to have in common.
I know. It would have been really nice if they had all woven together for me.
Yeah,
like
they were all twin brothers. All right. Yeah.
Oh, triplets. That would be amazing. Okay. So this story takes place in 1902. And this is about Dr. William Horatio Bates. He's a wealthy and influential ophthalmologist in New York City. The thing that the three of these two people do have in common is that they were not poor.
Mm-hmm.
They all had they were all pretty influential and like known for a thing before they went missing. And really after they went missing too.
Yeah.
And then that they went missing and reappeared. This guy has the added bonus that his son also disappeared at some point, but I could find nothing about what happened with him.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. So William Horatio Bates, August 30th, 1902, he writes a letter to his wife, Ada Seaman Bates, who's out of town visiting her mother. And he says, "My wife, I'm called out of town for some major operations. I'm going with Dr. Forsch, an old student, to do a mastoid, some cataracts, and other operations. He promises me a bonanza." Surgery people are fucking weird, man.
Bonanza of people to cut on.
That's right.
Yeah.
He says, "It's too bad to miss the horse show, but I'm glad to get so much money for us all. I'm in such a flurry. Don't worry. I'll send you letters later. You're lovingly, Willie." Okay.
Yep.
So he's already wealthy, but he's so excited about getting extra money, which is weird. He's in a super big hurry. And then he disappears. So he sends this letter and doesn't come home. He doesn't write to say where he's gone. He's just gone. When he doesn't reappear after a few days, his wife's like, "I'm very concerned about my husband. Like, this is unlike him." So she starts to inquire with family friends all across the U.S. and Europe, which I feel like this is a lot at this time. Early 1900s, that seems like a lot of people contact as a woman. And her husband was also a prominent Freemason, so she enlists the support of the local Masonic Society, which, of course, circulates his pictures all over the world. More work than a little private detective could probably handle. And eventually, a letter arrives from Britain, and they report that a man fitting his description was found working as a medical assistant in the Charing Cross Hospital in London after being admitted as a patient. And people that saw him reported that he was haggard, thin, and his eyes are really deeply sunken in. And later, he reported that he'd starved at various points during the 6 weeks that he'd been missing. He had a massive bank account, never touched, so he could have lived in luxury in London, but he didn't even realize, I guess, that he had it.
Huh.
So Mrs. Bates, who is so stoked someone has found her husband, hops on a ship to England, which I think takes like, 6 weeks itself just to get over there. How the hell did he get over there so quick, right? At any rate, I think it's 2 weeks. It does seem like a long time.
A week or two.
Yeah. In my head, I was like, it takes 2 months. I don't understand.
They got diesel engines by now. It's not so bad.
Right. So she gets there and she's so excited to see him. And he has no idea who she is. Absolutely nothing. And he looks at her and he's like, I don't know why you're bothering. We're total strangers. And so eventually she persuades him to stay at the Savoy Hotel, for a period of rest and recovery. And this is when he starts to get back some dim memories. So he vaguely remembers being called away from New York. He boarded a ship and performed an operation on somebody with a brain abscess. That sounds terrifying that he doesn't remember. Right?
Yeah.
So Mrs. Bates is super confused, but she's relieved. He's starting to kind of remember things. So she's like, we'll stay in London as long as you need to recover from this. And we'll try to get some more of your memories from your previous life to come forward. And then 2 days later, he just ups and leaves the hotel and disappears. And she never finds him again. That part's actually super sad. She looks for him for the rest of her life and never finds him.
Wow.
So he was at the height of his career when he disappeared. In his early 40s, he's pretty handsome, well-off, really respected. Everybody consults with him on unusual cases. He has degrees from Cornell and from the College of Physicians and Surgeons. He'd been attending at Bellevue and at the New York Eye Infirmary. He'd even taught ophthalmology for 5 years at the New York Postgrad Medical School and Hospital. So this is a pretty intense resume for someone to just disappear overnight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the poor wife looked for him in Europe and the East Coast of America for the rest of her life. She ended up dying in 1907. So 5 years later, she spent 5 years looking for him and she died holding a portrait of him because that was the only thing on her mind.
Yeah.
So 3 more years go by after her death and something very weird happens. Dr. J.E. Kelly, who's a really good friend of Dr. Bates from New York, happened to be passing through Grand Forks, North Dakota, a town in 1910 of about 12,000 people. And under circumstances lost to history, he stumbled upon Dr. Bates, his old friend, who has set up a small ophthalmology practice for himself in this town at some point after disappearing. Eventually, Dr. Kelly is like, what if you just came back to New York with me and, you know, attempted to live a life there? And Bates is like, I mean, I guess I could do that. Now, he's much more willing to go with this guy to a whole different state than he was to go with his wife back to a hotel for a few months, which I think is interesting. So once they get back to New York, the two ophthalmologists go into practice together and they had a small in-home like surgery, if you will, which once again is terrifying, these kinds of information in this day and age. Quietly, he lived with his old friend, built up his practice just like he'd done previously, and just kind of started over. But he never recovered his memories of his previous life in New York City. Reporters managed to piece together a collection loosely of stories that kind of hinted at a really sad experience. He ghosted across Europe. He was an itinerant doctor and then settled into North Dakota. And it was they wrote in one article, it's as if a chunk of his mind was removed like a slice of watermelon chopped away and eaten by an invisible monster. Makes you think he was the one with the brain abscess, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He ended up as an attending physician at the Harlem Hospital and eventually gets remarried. To most people, his life had resumed a rhythm of normalcy, with one major exception. In his chosen field of ophthalmology, where he'd been viewed for years as a luminary, he abruptly steps off the deep end. So in 1917, he debuted a new and unusual theory of eye care, which was called the Bates System of Eye Exercises. which was offered for the first time in Physical Culture, the name of a magazine. And basically a bunch of health quacks and, you know, snake oil salesmen promote it.
Yeah.
So they have this unexpected hit from this magazine subscription. And 3 years later, Bates publishes at his own expense a book with his various theories called The Cure of Imperfect Eyesight by Treatment Without Glasses. Super freaking weird,
yeah,
like, book. It's got a ton of misinformation and exaggeration. It's heavily illustrated with weird photographs. And his method to cure imperfect eyesight basically relies on a variety of concepts that flew directly at odds against decades of work he had done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote that the vision problems were almost exclusively caused by eye strain and nervous tension rather than the shape of the eyeball or formation of the lens, and that vision issues could be theoretically reduced in their severity or cured by doing eye exercises and completely learning how to relax your mind. So to no surprise, people really liked this because people did not want to wear glasses or get their eyes carved up at that time. And it's just a little weird. So finally in 1929, his method grows the ire of the federal... I just bit my tongue. That hurt really bad. Sorry. The Federal Trade Commission is displeased by his crazy ass book.
Yeah.
They issue a complaint against him for making false and misleading claims. This does nothing but fuel the fires of misinformation. Never seen that happen before. And it continues to grow in popularity, and people are really seduced by the idea of improving their eyesight without corrective measures. And people are convinced it works. If they do it, they have clearer vision. So some people, it actually did help, and they were able to throw away their glasses. I'd like to know how much it helped, but not my circus, not my monkeys. The most famous follower of the Bates method was Aldous Huxley from Brave New World. Been plagued by vision problems most of his life. And he wrote a book about his eye experience called The Art of Seeing, which was published in 1942.
Weird.
Yeah. So for some people, I guess it worked. Hi, Carmi. Mommy's busy right now. Can you go away? Thank you. So to this day, no one really knows what happened to him during his disappearance. The obituary from the New York Times said it was aphasia, which is what Agatha Christie, she had a fugue state, potentially, and had aphasia. Aphasia generally, though, is limited to just affecting your ability to communicate.
Yeah. Sounds like a euphemism for nervous breakdown instead of actual aphasia, but yeah.
Right, right. I think it meant something different in the early 1900s than we think of it now.
Yeah.
Now we probably would say it was amnesia, but that doesn't feel right either. Mm-hmm. Most people with amnesia usually know who they are, but have trouble learning new information and forming new memories. But once again, at the time, the definition was different, which is why we fall into the fugue definition, which is definitely what Agatha Christie fell into. So at this point, a fugue state, someone loses important autobiographical information and they just wander aimlessly. It's a pretty rare condition, and it only occurs in about 0.2% of the population. And he has most of the key symptoms from that. The other, of course, option is maybe he just fucking lied about it.
Yeah.
Maybe he just didn't want to live his life anymore, was tired of his wife. I doubt he was secretly in debt, which is, of course, like usually why men abandon their families.
Yeah.
But no idea. Whatever happened when he died in 1931, it went with him. Even though his idea of how to fix eyeballs is a little wackadoodle, people still do that into the 21st century. They still do the exercises to try to correct their eyes.
That's interesting. I mean, there are some things that you can actually do that with, but it's not nearsightedness, farsightedness. Like,
no.
Like Daniel had eye tracking issues and stuff, but it was, you know, those you could actually do eye exercises and get better. But
things like that, or like putting a patch on to help you correct your lazy eye, things like that make sense.
Yeah.
Just correcting your short-sightedness.
Yeah, yeah, not going to happen.
Not as much.
Yeah, I mean, to me, with him, it would almost make sense if he went to go do this thing and found himself in over his head in something dangerous. Like, he went to go perform these surgeries and found out he was working on the big mob boss, and then they drugged him or did whatever, ended up stuck there, couldn't go for help because then he would, you know, let people know he'd been doing this, and then got found and then was happy, but then disappeared. So he didn't have to say anything. And then years later figured it was long enough that he's okay and goes back to life. I don't know.
Yeah.
Seems weird.
A weird one. Cause you're right. Yeah, it does kind of read like a guy in witness protection or something, doesn't
it? Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go on to the third guy.
All right.
This one you might know. He was a mathematician / physicist in 1906.
All right.
Also, think about the years that all these are happening.
This is all about the same time. It's also not that far off of the Agatha Christie time, too. I mean, hers was a little later, but it was. But yeah, no, I don't know of any physicists that vanished, so I'm going to have to find out.
Ettore Majorana.
All right.
Absolutely pronounced terribly. This is Italian. Ettore Majorana? I don't know.
Not someone I know. So.
Well, great.
I can't help you there.
So he was born in 1906, graduated from high school early, headed to Rome and studied engineering and physics under the physicist Enrico Fermi.
There's an Italian physicist I know. All right.
There we go, right? So for those of us that didn't know, Fermi was awarded for his demonstrations of the existence of new radioactive elements produced by neutron irradiation, and for his related discovery of nuclear reactions brought on by slow neutrons. And he thought that Ettore was so amazing that he hired him to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, there are several categories of scientists in the world, those of the second or third rank to their best guy, but they never get very far. And then there's like the number one top of the line kind of fella. And this guy was your number one top of the line kind of fella.
Okay.
He is fundamental to scientific progress, according to Fermi. He said, and there are geniuses like, so then there's geniuses. I'm sorry, I screwed up this quote already. Then there's geniuses like Galileo and Newton. And he thought that Ettore Majorana was on the ilk of Galileo and Newton.
Hmm.
He was, big things were going to come from this kid, right?
Yeah.
He hung his hat there. So in the short time that Majorana worked with him, he achieved a lot. So he was inclined to publish a lot of his work and probably would have won a Nobel Prize for discovering the neutron. But, you know, he disappeared. And in 1931, Irene Curie Jolette and Frederick Jolette studied radiation from beryllium hitting paraffin wax, which pushed out protons. And they believed that the particle was a proton, given that it was a neutral particle and that it was the only one they knew of at the time. But Majorana and Chadwick realized, Chadwick's the guy that actually gets the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Mystery particle would have to be neutral and near the mass of the proton to move something with as much mass as a proton. And Majorana wrote to Fermi with his hypothesis, and Fermi was like, write it up! Write it up! Never happened. So Chadwick had time to do his own experiments, and he does publish his results. Nevertheless, Majorana had a pretty distinguishing career. He worked with Bohr and Heisenberg and Fermi. They helped develop Heisenberg's theory of the nucleus and predicting particles, which are now known as Majorana fermions.
Hmm.
Will's like, I'm Googling this shit now. Now we push
I know
the
fermions,
button.
But I don't know that type of fermion. So there we go.
Apparently, they finally observed it maybe in 2012/2014.
Okay.
I don't know. But 1938 rolls around. And it's March 25th, and Majorana sends a note to the head of the Naples Physics Institute saying he's not going to be returning. He says, "Dear Corelli, I made a decision that's become unavoidable. There isn't a bit of selfishness in it, but I realized what trouble my sudden disappearance will cause you and the students. For this as well, I beg your forgiveness, but especially for betraying the trust, the sincere friendship, and the sympathy you gave me over the past months. I ask you to remind me to all those who... all those I learned to know and appreciate in your institute, especially Scuti. I will keep a fond memory of them until at least 11 p.m. tonight, possibly later." That's a weird fucking letter.
That's a weird statement. Yeah.
Right. Then he sends a second letter from Palermo saying he'd return the next day, but didn't want to teach anymore. I get it. Teaching's a pain in the ass. I wouldn't want to do it either. Nevertheless, his boss is like, this is weird. Does anybody else think this is weird? So he contacts Majorana's family, and it's confirmed that he was traveling from Palermo to Naples on a steamer on March 25th, but no one saw him. He totally disappeared. So what happened to him is the question.
Yeah.
One theory is that he died by suicide, which is plausible. However, a week before he went missing, his life savings is emptied out of the bank, which more likely points to him abandoning his life, moving abroad, joining a monastery or something like that. He was a devout Catholic.
Yeah, and also time-wise, this is fascist Italy, so he might be on the run from Mussolini and company too. I don't know. So
that is one of the theories, right?
Yeah.
So some of the out there theories is that he became homeless in Naples and would help local students on the street with their homework, which I think is cute.
Became the homeless homework fairy of Naples.
Right. And like, if that's a thing, that's actually really cute. Maybe he was kidnapped by the Nazis or murdered by them out of fear that his work would lead to the creation of an atomic bomb before they could do it. Maybe.
A little early for that, but yeah.
Yeah, it's early. It's 1938. I mean, it's a little early. So we don't want to get rid of some of the simple solutions because they're valid. But the theory that he left the country was the one that gains the most support by the Italian police in 2011. A couple years later, they reopened the case to investigate a witness who claimed that they had met Majorana in Venezuela, which also is not that weird. People from Europe sure did love South America during this period of time, right?
Yeah.
So witnesses claimed that they had been told by a mutual acquaintance that the man who was kind of a shy 50-ish year old man known as Beamy, who refused to be photographed, was a famed scientist. They did get one kind of blurry photograph of Beamy, and it's analyzed by Italian authorities. And after investigating, they're like, this actually might be him.
Mm-hmm.
This actually might be this guy that went missing in 1938, even though it's 2011 now, right?
Yeah.
So they believe that he maintained a relationship with his uncle, a physicist by the name of Carino Majorana. That name is killing me. And they would discuss scientific topics under the name of W.G. Conklin. The reason why they believe this is that they found a postcard from Carino Majorana in Beanie's car in Venezuela. Some people suggested that he got tired of his life in Italy and moved to escape the war in fascist Italy. Others that he realized the implications of his work with regards to atomic weapons and chose to leave because of that. And it's possible, the other thing is that it's really possible that he escaped the country because he might have been gay, which his family is like leaning towards that as the option, actually, because it would have been really horrible during that period of time.
Yeah, and that would be the time to get the hell out of that part of Europe. But
right. Especially if someone was holding something over you.
Yeah.
You would just want to GTFO. Don't know. The end of the day. We don't know on this one. But that one's like the most likely is that it's the same guy, Beanie, in Venezuela.
Okay.
So, well,
that's pretty wild.
I know, right?
Yeah. Another one. You got to find this guy and dig him up. All right.
I know. But
time
also
to go wild with the DNA testing. But
this particular guy, if he did escape to Venezuela because he was gay and he was trying to find a safe place to live, I kind of just want to leave that one alone. Like, if that's the reason, I don't, you know, he lived a hard enough life. He's done. I'm good with that.
But he also escaped, and it'd be kind of nice to know if, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
This guy was actually murdered, or whether he did just get away and not have to deal with all this crap or what. But
would be interesting.
Yeah.
So if we go down the rabbit hole, approximately 2,300 Americans are reporting missing every day, both children and adults. This does not include those who have vanished in other countries, individuals who disappeared and are never reported, the homeless, or their children. On average, there is 1 million people a year that go missing.
Wild.
Right? It's crazy. One of the things that they did to help find missing people is in the 1980s, milk cartons with photos of missing children on them made their debut. The first child to appear on one of those milk cartons was Ethan Potts, who was a six-year-old from New York who disappeared walking to the bus stop May of 1975. He has never been found. However, the man who killed him confessed in 2012.
Okay.
Also, it's wild to think about how frequently children go missing in America when you've got countries like Japan where three-year-olds are walking down the street and going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
Or people that leave their babies in the bassinet outside of restaurants while they go enjoy dinner. Like,
yep.
It's insane. Anywho, minorities who suffer from mental disorders and substance abusers who go missing often receive little to no attention from authorities and little sympathy from the press or the public. We know that minorities in general get very little attention, especially when it comes to women. If you're a white woman, you're more likely to get recognized on national news because of something called damsel in distress syndrome that Americans suffer from.
Yeah.
So that's the story of the missing reappeared in the 1900s. Yeah. Very weirdly specific, but yeah.
No, it's interesting. I mean, they're all have just enough similarity and enough differences that it's kind of fascinating, but yeah. Yeah, it's always strange, yeah, especially when you have missing people that are prominent citizens that everybody knows that are this kind of, you know, some level of notoriety that just kind of vanish. And then to have them turn up again is even weirder. And
it's funny because, like, even if you throw Agatha Christie into this mix, we're looking at people in their mid to late 40s
mm-hmm.
that are fairly wealthy and they're ahead in their field. They're pretty, like, well-known, like you said.
Yeah.
And they just effing disappear.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely makes you think of whether it's just a stress reaction, sort of like, I just want to get away from this life, so I'm just going to run off and,
right.
You know, chalk it up to whatever makes people feel good about it, but I really just don't want to be part of this life anymore, and I'm a big enough person and famous enough person that I can't just back away easily, so I've got to go vanish or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Super weird. That's what it is. It's super weird.
Yeah. No, pretty fascinating though. So yeah, cool. Cool subject. I'm going to have to go look up the physicist now because
You're like, I need to know what a Majorana particle is now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so cool stuff. But yeah, you know, thanks for the stories, and thank you everybody for listening this week. You know, as always, rate, review, and subscribe. Tell your friends about our podcast, and basically catch us in a week. We'll see you next Tuesday. Bye, folks. Bye-bye.